I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. Thank You, Goodnight, the Jon Bon Jovi story, is a four-part docuseries on Hulu that takes you on a very personal journey with one of the most successful bands in rock and roll history. During a post-screening Q&A of the first episode at the Motion Picture Association here in Washington, D.C. on April 23rd, I talked to none other than Jon Bon Jovi. We got into why New Jersey has always been at the center of the band's identity, how Jon quickly pulled together a band after he wrote a runaway hit, whether he has ever talked to Richie Sambora again, his health challenges, and why his JBJ Soul Kitchen restaurants are important to him and his wife, Dorothea.
By now, you already know who this is, Jon Bon Jovi. Welcome back to Washington. I know you're here a lot, but what a fantastic first episode of four of Thank You, Goodnight.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Now, you told me you've seen this about 100 times. Just give us your, what do you think of it? Mindful that everyone hasn't seen all four episodes.
It gets better. You see your life flash before your eyes, and then you're supposed to die. I've seen my life flash before my eyes, and I'm feeling good. So that's a positive. But I'm pleased with the outcome. And it was emotional to see, you know, everything that we've done in these 40 years. It's been emotional.
So there, I took lots of notes when I watched the first episode yesterday, and then took more notes watching it here tonight, and also listening to the reaction of the audience. You know, there's something that keeps coming up in this first episode from various people, and it's, there's something about this guy. And I kept coming back to that because you even talked about the fact that, you know, there was no plan B, ever.
No.
And you even said, I wasn't the best singer. I didn't even know how to write songs. I just did this. Where did this blind faith in being who you are now come from?
Some of it, honestly, was naivete. Simply because the drinking age was 18. And I don't mean that in an alcohol kind of way. You could sneak into the bar at 16 and cut your teeth. I think that at 14, 15, 16, every kid dreams of being an astronaut, an athlete, or a rock and roll star. And that, you know, I wasn't very good at school, so astronaut was checked off. My athletic abilities got in the way with the long hair, and I had white spikes with green stripes when I was on the baseball team. I looked good, but I was playing right field, so, you know, the career wasn't going to go very far. But there was something about music that innately was me. It was me. And I say that, and I say it more now. I wasn't the best anything, but I would outwork everybody. There was nobody that had a work ethic like I did.
But for someone who didn't come from a musical family, you weren't even trained in it. But how did you know that you're going to, in terms of working at it, no one was going to work harder than you? What did that really entail?
A guy moved in across the street that's depicted in there. And he was sort of a hipster. He was much younger than my parents, but much older than me, which helped. He played in a lounge band, which in my eyes meant he was gigging. He was big as far as I was concerned. And most importantly, when he put that guitar in my hand, he didn't teach me boring scales and things that would put a 13-year-old to sleep. He said, "You want to learn how to play The House of the Rising Sun? Now suddenly you can sing a song." I played it poorly, but that wasn't the point. When I went back the second week and I pretended to rehearse practice, when I went back the third week and I pulled his leg and said, "Yeah, I worked so hard at it," he cursed at me and said, "Don't waste my effing time. Get out of my house. You know, I have a wife and kids. I can't waste my time with you." That was the greatest thing that ever happened, because the next time I came back, I knew it. You know, and it was like, okay, I can do this. I'll figure it out. He was a great catalyst, you know, that it's going to take work. You don't just get to do this. People think that, you know, they can all sing because they sing in the shower. That's not singing, buddy. You know, let me tell you about what it takes to go out there and do this, you know.
I want to go back to your saying that the drinking age was 18, you were 16, and it's easier to look 18 when you're 16 than to look 21 when you're when you're 18.
Yeah.
And so you're going to places like the Stone Pony and other places.
Yes, other places more.
And I bring this up because a big part of your identity is New Jersey.
Yes.
I mean, we're both Jersey boys. I'm
sorry, where are you from?
I was born in Newark.
Oh.
And you could tell
Senator Booker said to bust his chops about that.
Yeah. Yeah, you could tell Cory Booker. I've got some words for him later. But no, I was born in Newark, but we left Newark and moved to Hazlitt, New Jersey, Monmouth County. And I went on the map because when you're driving on the parkway and trying to get to Hazlitt, I remember seeing that Sayreville Water Tower that's there. So you're only 12 miles away. You know, the fact that you're someone who didn't want to run away, no pun intended here, didn't want to run away from your New Jersey roots, but embrace them. Talk about why that was so important to you, to embrace where you were from in the work that you were doing.
A number of things. One is there was no reason to have to leave. We were blessed enough to have had all come from working family backgrounds. We were brought up in that blue collar kind of New Jersey work ethos. So we had roofs over our head, food on the table, which was very good and very helpful. There was the shadow of Manhattan, which was New York City, the greatest city in the world. All the media that was on your television, your radio, your newspapers that you read. Then 30 miles south, what seemed impossible existed. Now, they weren't the big stars that you thought, you know, or even became. You know, Bruce and the E Street Band were not born in the USA, Bruce and the E Street Band yet. You know, they were born to run Bruce, which was still theaters. And then there was years when I came up, and this is sort of somewhat integral, 76, 77, 78. There was no record from those guys either. So Southside was starting to be their kind of offshoot, and Southside was cutting his teeth. Point is that the impossible was possible, but even they weren't too big to touch. And there were 17 of them between the two bands. So it was like meeting Snow White and all the Seven Dwarfs wherever you went. Again, very inspirational for a young boy. So guys from the Jukes would come to the basement to teach us the proper way to play the horn parts. The keyboard you hear on Runaway is Roy Bittan from the E Street Band. It wasn't David. It was before I had a band. You know, so I was that kid. They go, the kid's pretty good. The kid's pretty good. The kid's pretty good. I was getting better.
The kid's pretty good. Can we just talk about Runaway? And I was shocked to learn that you have this hit song and no band.
No.
And you had to pull all these people as we
for a temporary 3 week. There was a strip mall in Hazlitt. Movie theater at the end of the show.
Yes.
That was Bon Jovi's first gig.
Shut up.
First gig.
I saw Poltergeist in that theater.
In that strip mall. That was our first gig ever in that in that theater. It was about this big. Yes. First gig in Hazlitt. And up the street was the Fountain Casino.
Well, that I didn't know.
That was a big, that became a big club. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, yes.
So you have this big hit. You have no band.
No.
And what I loved, what we learned later, is that you pulled all these people together, including your friend Bobby, who you've known each other since you were like 16.
David,
the keyboard player, David, since you were 16. And you said it was meant to be 3 weeks, not 40 years.
Yeah, couldn't get rid of him.
But with Runaway, it just, that you guys just took off.
Having a song on the radio was huge. D.C. was one of the eight cities that Doubleday owned the station in. So I was on the radio in Washington, D.C., and there was no chance that we could, you know, ever play here. But that was what led to me getting a record deal. When I got these guys together and asking each of them kindly, would you please do me a favor and take advantage of this opportunity with and for me, and then go back to your business? Because when you think about it, Tico is 9 years older than I am. He was in a band called Frankie and the Knockouts who had a record deal. He had a house and a wife and a roof overhead, and he was on the road. Alec, the bass player who had been the conduit to so much of this, was making a lot of money playing other people's music. Richie was aspiring to be in his own original band and trying to write songs on his own. And David was going to Rutgers to go to school to, you know.
To be a doctor.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. You saved him from that.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the process and songwriting? Because there are a bunch of quotes that I took notes on from that first episode. The joy is in the oneness with the song. Mm-hmm. Your heart is 80% of the thing. Mm-hmm. I don't need adulation. This comes later. I don't need adulation. This is bigger than girls and guitars. Made me wonder, you know, songwriting is important, but how important is the audience to you? I mean, you get great joy from writing the music, writing the lyrics, but how much of then taking that song and performing it before an audience, how much of that plays into the work that you do?
It's third on my list, because I've always said writing it is great, seeing if what you've written is worth it when you record it, and then ultimately going out and performing it. Performing it and seeing the way those songs have touched people moves me. It moves me now. Sure it does. You know, when you hear the opening chords of Living on a Prayer and you see what happens, you go, yeah, I get it. It's my life and all these songs over the years. I get it. I'm appreciative for sure. But it's third on the list. I just happen to be good at it. And I enjoy it. But my fingernail marks have always been in the driveway all the way. They pull me out of the driveway every year to go to support any record. And then I get to the hotel and then I'm fine. But between between the front door and the first hotel, I'm bitching and moaning.
Of all, what's your favorite song?
I can't say that. Can't.
The favorite.
Can't.
You can.
It's the next one. It's the next one.
Well, speaking of the next one, your new album, the 16th album.
16th Forever. Band album. It's my 18th album if you count the solo albums. Yeah.
If you count the solo albums.
Yeah.
Comes out in June. So if your favorite song is the next one, what song from Forever is your favorite?
It's a trick question. It's a journalist of him. I don't know. But, you know, I'll tell you one other magic story that's happening on this new record, which is not surprising, but on the other hand, it surely is something I'm grateful for. So we write this song called Legendary, and this simple sounding lyric of I've got what I want because I got what I need, a fistful of friends who will stand up for me. Right where I am is where I want to be. It's because of what you witnessed here in this film. It sounds simple. Why is it connecting with the people that it's connecting with? We were just in London a couple of days ago, and the Japanese press contingent came over, and they said, we've just made this the theme song of a new television program because it relates directly to the characters. And I was so pleased, but I wasn't surprised, because people go through these times in their life where they go, that's really what matters. And it's the same way when we wrote It's My Life, and I had a fight for the lyric, like Frankie said, I did it my way. It was about Frank Sinatra. But no, it wasn't. The day it was released, it became about Frankie is your buddy, it's your brother, it's you. Tommy and Gina, dating back to Living on a Prayer, is every man. And of course, that song has transcended, you know, decades of people and language barriers and countries and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So I know what these songs have done for people. I'm pleased, but I'm not surprised that Legendary is connecting the way it is.
I've already lost how much time we have left, so I'm just going to keep going. But I'm also not going to, I don't want to try to spoil what's going to come in episodes 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
But I just want to touch on one particular thing. How deep do you get into the situation with Richie Sambora?
Just this shy of having something that his mom wouldn't be okay with watching. Because that's still important to me. Mm-hmm. But you had to tell the truth and make sure that he was still comfortable with it. You know, the cliches of rock stardom have pulled many a man and woman down. And this was no exception. Alec was no exception. Tico went through it. I was just blessed and never went through it. David never went through it. But... he had been in and out of rehabs a couple of times, and we were literally on the road in 2013, and he didn't show up, and it wasn't good. And, you know, so he made a decision not to want to do this any longer, and it's heartbreaking, but you have other bandmates, you have 120 people that you work for, that work for you on the road, you have millions of people who bought tickets and are traveling around the globe to see you. The show goes on. You know, you got to keep going.
Again, I don't want to be a spoiler, but do y'all talk?
Yeah. He came and watched the first three episodes, just the two of us at my house. There is no animus from the day he quit. There was no animus because these are situations that are personal and, more importantly, really just for him to figure out. You know, I mean, being in a rock band is not a life sentence. It's a choice that you make in a career path. And his staying home and becoming a better dad as a result, and as a single parent and getting on with his life, there's no animus. You know, I can't be angry with a guy for, you know, ultimately choosing that he didn't care to do this any longer. But, you know, we know what the bases of it was.
And the problems with your vocal cords, you had surgery. How deep do we get into that?
You're in the room with me. You know, I didn't anticipate any of this happening, and I didn't anticipate Gotham shooting at all. But once he did, I'm not afraid to show that this is, you know, life, not just some silly rock band, but there's a life of, you know, five or seven men that have been behind that. I'm not afraid of showing that. We just never had a platform for it. And what you see here on the screen is a year and 2 years old, remember? So I'm much further down the road to recover. There's no miracles. It's science. It's medicine. It's up to God. But I'm well on the way.
I love what you just said just now. You're not afraid to show what was going on. And I think, you know, folks here would agree, in just seeing episode one, at least for me, just the humility is the word that comes to mind, but just how, I don't know, very accessible. It didn't feel manufactured. It didn't feel staged. It felt like we literally were following you with our own camcorders, watching you do all the things.
It gets way more personal than the first. The episode had to set this up. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sort of embarrassed to show the first episode with the baby pictures, but it had to set it up. It gets way deeper.
Wait, why are you embarrassed?
I'm not embarrassed of my baby pictures. I'm embarrassed that it's like seemingly to me self-indulgent, but Gotham needed to set it up that way, so I understood. And I had no creative control over this whole thing. And I could back up those words by saying I was too busy writing a record and dealing with this throat surgery. So that's what, you know, that's the honest to God truth, Your Honor.
So no creative control. You had no, so then why'd you want
to
do this? Was it
to mark the 40th?
Literally to mark the 40th.
Yeah. Well, that was my decision. It was my finding and hiring Gotham. It was simultaneously archiving everything that is in there I had. And a 40th anniversary doesn't come too often, you know, even if, who knows if I'll be around for the 50th.
I loved what you were doing the riff on, you know, just when you would call it quits. You don't want to do anything that would damage the legacy, and you're smiling because I think you know what I'm going to say. I'm never going to be the fat Elvis.
I said that when I was 25. You know, there's just no chance I'd walk away. It matters to me. You know, this is my life's work, and I've lived for and loved every minute of it, so I didn't make any bad decisions. I made some wrong decisions, but I didn't make any bad decisions.
Give me a wrong decision.
Called the fourth album New Jersey.
Wait, yeah. Hold on.
First time I was ever compared to Bruce. We never wanted to be compared to Bruce. That was Jesus and the apostles. We had no desire to be ever considered any of that. We're not. They were an influence, but the critics would write, Lou Reed put out an album called New York, and Bon Jovi, this trite rock band, put out New Jersey. Whoa, 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 whoa. And they're like, Bruce Springsteen, whoa, 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 whoa. That was a kiss of death. in Jersey to be compared to the E Street Band. They were it. We were our own thing. That was one flavor in the mix of things. But if you didn't develop your own voice, sound, look, that was career suicide in New Jersey.
All right, give me another mistake.
Not meeting Frank Sinatra. That's how few I have. I could have and should have, and I wasn't ready for it until after he passed. And then, of course, I regretted it immensely.
What do you mean you weren't ready?
I wasn't emotionally ready for it. You had an opportunity to meet him and did... My mom was a Playboy bunny in the first club back in the beginning of the early 60s. She was married to my dad. They met in the Marine Corps. There's pictures of my mom and dad with Frank and the whole kind of blah, 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 with Diane Lane's mother and Lauren Hutton. So she goes backstage with a cover of Rolling Stone. It says, "Mr. Sinatra, this is my kid. If you remember me, I was a waitress in the club." And I'm Slippery When Wet in New Jersey at this point. So I'd had the opportunity on more than one occasion, and I was like, I get it, but no, I'll pass. It was like 99, just when he passed. I was like, I'm smart enough now. I'd like to, I wish. You know, and you know, anyhow.
If you had met him... Now, what would you say to him, want to know from him, compare notes?
Oh, I could compare so many notes. Working within four presidents, you know, doing movies, owning the company, you know, so many things that I stole from Frank Sinatra.
Earlier, you said, like, this is my life's work.
Yeah.
But it's not the only thing that you're
right.
doing. I mean, you've got, I don't know if you noticed in the credits, but I think it was like the last thing listed in the first column was JBJ's Soul Kitchen. There are four of them?
Yes.
All in New Jersey?
Yes.
Talk more about them.
Some 20 years ago, I started a foundation when I used to own an arena football team. There was a little kind of a wonderful, fun sport. And I thought, okay, how are we going to win the hearts and minds of the folks of Philadelphia with the big four in the community? So we need to be more philanthropic. Originally, you're playing Robin Hood, and eventually I realized that homelessness is hunger was something that we could affect. So I met this nun by the name of Sister Mary Scullion, and she taught me everything I eventually have learned about the homeless and hunger issues. And eventually we started building affordable housing. Economic downturn of 2008 happens. Dorothea's watching the news one night and stream of consciousness says, we have to feed the people that you've just housed. Here's how I would dream we go about it. We started a pilot program some 13 years ago, built the first one, learned from it. Sandy hit the superstorm mm-hmm. in New Jersey. We took over a supermarket, so it contained then a food bank, a food pantry, culinary program, service provider, all under our roof. Third one was on a college campus because we learned when our kids went to college, there are hungry kids on campuses of schools. We went to Rutgers and said, you can either take the credit or, you know, get ready to get thrown under the bus. They absolutely embraced us and said, bring it on. You know, let's do this on our campus. And then we went to Jersey City University, which are the real kind of kids in a smaller university setting that needed it even more. And so we have four of them.
But these are... What's unique about these restaurants?
It's a pay, not pay what you can model. That is a misnomer. It is not that, because in essence, if you left a nickel and said, that's all I can leave, but I don't want to volunteer. Yeah, you win. But that's not the idea. There's no government funding. It's not institutional foods. It's all farm to table. If you or I go there and you want to affect change directly, leave us the suggested donation, which not only covers your meal, but the cost of the meal for somebody in need in the restaurant, which helps us make ends meet. And then those are in need and have never been with us, volunteer. Now, Jonathan, if you came and did not volunteer, you'd honestly feel like you're missing out on the party, because it's such a sense of community. And before COVID, you're meeting people from different walks of life, i.e. the economic downturn of 2008 happens. People who lose their jobs, white collar jobs, they suddenly give up that life and they're downsizing. So you'll have a guy, and we learned this the hard way, I used to work on Wall Street. It didn't work out. I realized she didn't love me. Blah, blah, blah. And so now he's volunteering in the kitchen. You think he's in dire straits, and he may be economically in this moment, but don't mistake a nice clean shirt with a guy that still needed to eat tonight. And yet he could sit next to you at that table and converse in a way that he's going to end up helping you in some kind of business. Because a lot of times people walk by someone that's, use your mind's eye for a minute, in a homeless situation. We're all guilty of this. At one time in your life, you have walked by somebody that's on the street or at a stoplight. There's a story behind that guy or that lady. Chances are they came from a background that wouldn't surprise you because they were educated or in a family or, you know, things that led them to this. When we created this model, it was community service. The second one, we realized that, oh, they need service providing, helping with job training or application filling. Yeah, I've been in the workforce for so long, I forgot how to fill out an application. Having people do that, getting them to a lawyer or a doctor or clinic. That's what our second one did. Then we had a culinary program, which was immediate job training. Oh, yes, by the way, I'm homeless. What are you going to do? Get in your Range Rover and go to the food pantry? How am I getting there? It's under our roof. You know, that's a volunteer opportunity. Get your groceries, come in, sit down, eat, but stock the shelves while you're over at the food pantry. That was our third one. Now, go to Rutgers, we say to the chancellor, have you ever been in your food pantry? She said, no, I haven't. Let's go. Here's volunteer opportunities for the kids there. Let's call the local ShopRite. Stock those shelves. Come through the door. We'll make you a nice meal. You know, that's all this is. It's not genius. It's just passion.
And I loved you mentioned ShopRite because that is a very New Jersey supermarket. We're running out of time, but I can't have you here and not have you talk about your philanthropy. And you're very politically involved. Why is it important to you to be that civically involved?
Probably the place we came up and when we came up and feeling blessed, obviously, but it's just in my bones at this point. I don't know why. It's just become a part of my life and my wife's life, and it's sort of what we do. And you know, the it's not for accolades. You know, washing dishes isn't going to win you any trophies, but it does inspire a song on occasion, you know, and you're right, do what you can because of COVID. And it makes you feel good. I can tell you that it makes me feel good when I wash a dish at the kitchen because I know we've affected change directly.
Last question. When everyone's done watching, thank you, good night. After it debuts on April 26th. What do you want them to take away from this?
That any team or family or rock and roll band has good days and bad days, that anything worth fighting for is worth getting punched in the nose over, that... you know, it there may not always be a happy end, but it's certainly worth putting in the time and see what happens at the end of the day. Because when you rest your head on your pillow, you wonder if it was all worth it, you know. So it was worth it. I don't know what the outcome is. I hope I'm back at the arena here, but if it's not, I'm good.
John Bon Jovi, everyone.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to K-Part. This week's episode was edited by Kwari Aline. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan K-Part. You can find me on X at KpartJ.